Welcome to See How They Run, horse race coverage from the left, brought to you by The Nation. I'm D.D. Guttenplan, editor of The Nation. With just a few weeks to go until the 2024 election, both parties are throwing everything they've got at the key battleground states that will decide whether Donald Trump or Kamala Harris gets to sleep in the White House in January. And today, we're going to take a look at the state that Trump recently called the toughest of the swing states to win, Wisconsin. It's a state that has long defied easy categorization, the birthplace of the Republican Party and sewer socialism, the political home of fighting Bob La Follette and tail gunner Joe McCarthy, the state that gave us Scott Walker and Tammy Baldwin, and Trump and Harris are both desperate to win it. So what do we need to understand about Wisconsin right now? Where are the places that will decide whether it turns red or blue? And are the Democrats doing enough to keep Trump at bay? To discuss all of that, we're joined by two Wisconsin all-stars, Ben Wickler, chair of the Wisconsin Democratic Party, and the nation's resident badger, John Nichols. Welcome, both of you, to See How They Run.
Great to be with you.
Super excited to be with you.
Great to see you both again. John, always a pleasure to have you back. And Ben, I'm going to begin with the impertinent question. Are you doing enough?
Well done. This race is tied right now. And it's tied up and down the ballot. It's tied at the presidential level. It's tied in the U.S. Senate race, which is not something that I expected to be saying. The full force of the right-wing money machine has slammed into our state like a hurricane. In House races, we have multiple jump ball races, also not something that you normally hear in Wisconsin, but look in the first and third congressional districts. And then because we finally defeated the gerrymander, we have a jump ball state assembly majority and a set of seats in the state Senate that could flip. We have been fighting to prevent Republican supermajorities, but now the gerrymander is over. And so now it's tied. And what that means is that at every level, everything we can possibly do might be the thing that tips the entire state and affects a federal trifecta and the future of a Democratic or Republican trifecta in Wisconsin. So if you ask, are we doing enough? No, we need to do more and more and more all the way through. Absolutely. Because anything could be the thing that tips the entire thing. That is what I wake up thinking. That's what I fall asleep thinking. And the one thing that I'm gratified by is that so many thousands of people are doing so much already. But if anyone listening right now has a heartbeat, get involved in the final stretch because this state is up for grabs.
And what if they just have a wallet, Ben?
Well, you can. We're only allowed to accept contributions from living people because they're disclosed. So you have to have a heartbeat and a wallet. But we can make use of money. We have ways to spend in the final stretch to help get out the vote, to help. There's both a handful, maybe 4% of the state that's persuadable, that is mostly Republicans who are divided about whether they could actually cast a ballot for Trump again this time. And then there's another group of people who we call persuade to participate, who might or might not vote. And there are hundreds of thousands of those people on both sides. So our ability to go out and make the case to those folks that casting a ballot now will affect the things that they care most about in their lives, it really does make a difference. And what we know is Wisconsin, it literally can come down to the last few hours of the election. We have same-day voter registration. So you can walk in at 7:55 p.m. on Tuesday, November 5th. And once you're in line, you're allowed to vote. You can register to vote and cast a ballot right at the end. That's why I keep knocking on doors until right before the polls close. This is going to come down to the wire, and it means that we can put money and volunteer time to work all the way through.
So let me follow up briefly before we hear from John, who I know is raring to go on this. John and I have had a running, very friendly argument for months now over whether it's all going to come down to Pennsylvania, which is my bet, or Wisconsin. But today we're making the case for Wisconsin. So tell us a little bit more about these two congressional races that have become unexpectedly competitive and what's going on there, who's running, and why they're suddenly competitive.
Well, the big thing is that I think national Democrats have woken up to the fact that the way that these maps are drawn, these are only slightly Trump-leaning districts. So that's the first is the former district of Paul Ryan, now Brian Steil, Paul Ryan's protege, and he is up against a serious challenger who's got running the best campaign we've seen in a number of years. Obviously, there was a huge fight against Paul Ryan when it was a redder set of lines. But we have Peter Barca, who was a congressman from this district in the 90s, went on to become the Democratic Assembly leader during the Act 10 battle. He is the most kind of bluff, kind, like positive, energetic guy, so Kenosha to his core that you'll ever meet. And he's running a campaign that is based on optimism and a belief in freedom and fighting back against the extremism we've seen from the Republicans and supporting unions and working people, which is a core tenet of Wisconsin progressivism, you know, going back 150 years. In the 3rd congressional district, you have Derek Van Orden, who is a kind of a poster guy for what is wrong with the MAGA temperament at this moment. He's nationally famous for exploding in rage, yelling at teenagers in the U.S. Senate, in front of a group of people he was taking on a tour. He did the same thing in a library in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. This is a guy who, after he lost when he ran in 2020, went to the Stop the Steal rally, was on Capitol grounds on January 6th. Not someone you want representing a purple district in the U.S. House. And if he wins, he'll be inside Congress when the Electoral College votes are certified in January 6th, 2025. So we want to make sure he is outside of Congress at that moment. And we've got Rebecca Cook on our side, grew up in a dairy farm outside of Eau Claire. She's waitressing tables while she's running for Congress. And she has so much energy and focus on fighting to represent regular folks, rural communities, stand up for women's freedom to make their own decisions, stand up for small family farms and against big agribusiness monopolies, stand up for working folks like the people she grew up with and is herself now. She is giving Derek Van Orden a serious run for his money. So both of these districts are on the DCCC's red to blue list. These are both considered some of the best pickup opportunities for Democrats in the country. They're both within the margin of error. Which side depends on which day you wake up. This is a real fight in both of those districts. And then there's more. I could mention Kristen Lierley in the 8th congressional district. But it's a pretty rough district in terms of the shape of the lines, but she's running a dynamite campaign that is, I think, kind of shocking Republicans to see the kind of energy she's building in small towns. If she wins, she'd be the first pro-choice OBGYN woman elected to Congress. And
wow.
This issue that motivates voters at every level of the ballot, it is front and center in that race. And we have candidates in every district. So this at the House race, you know, Wisconsin could tip the majority in the U.S. House. It's a pretty amazing thing.
So talk a little bit, John, if you will. I mean, I want to give you your head because this is your territory, man. I mean, I know Ben is the chair of the state party, but you are Mr. Wisconsin to our readers. So I don't want to impose too much on what you have to say, but I do have two questions I'd like you to address. One is, why is Tammy Baldwin's race unexpectedly competitive? And two is, how is abortion playing out in this race?
Glad to address both of them and glad to be on with Ben, who I have known since he was 12 years old, just so you recognize. And that's sort of one of the realities of Wisconsin politics. I know Ben very, very well. I've known him since he was a child in middle school. And I know the Republican Party chair very, very well and have known him, you know, probably certainly most of my life.
Since he was knocking over gas stations as a teenager, no doubt.
Nah, he didn't do that as much as you might expect. Actually, the weird thing about it is, and go right to your question in a second, but the fascinating thing about Wisconsin is that people love Wisconsin politics because Wisconsin politics is real. It is always competitive. It always has been competitive. And so kids come up in it and I think get drawn into it. And that is true with Ben. It is true with Brian Schimming, the chair of the Republican Party, who used to ride his bike down to Republican campaign headquarters when he was 12 or 13 to volunteer. So these two leaders have been on the same trajectory, only with opposite ideology. So that's a good way of setting up Wisconsin, though, and you know, kind of getting to the heart of what's going on in Wisconsin at this point. And I think your second question was about abortion. The first thing you were asking was about
Tammy Baldwin.
And, you know, look, Tammy Baldwin has generally done a little bit better than the Democrats. She is a Democrat, obviously, but she has a fascinating record. In 2012, when she got elected, she won one more county than Barack Obama. In 2018, when she got reelected, where she had a relatively weaker Republican opponent, she ran, you know, a good deal ahead of Tony Evers, who was beating Scott Walker for governor. So she's got this pattern of running a little bit ahead of the party. And she is, I expect, will do that again. So if she's not doing well, that's a problem for Ben, because that means that the candidate who usually does best, you know, is in a challenging situation. I would suggest that she may not be in as bad shape as some people think. I've seen her out campaigning. She runs her own kind of campaign. She goes to the parts of the state that she wants to go to, which is often more rural, industrial towns, factory towns. She builds out her base in some pretty smart ways. And I think she's still doing that. But why she's having a tough race this year is pretty simple. A California multimillionaire who does have roots in Wisconsin but lived outside the state for a long time came home and brought all of his money. And
he Eric is, Harvey, let's name his name here. This is the nation. We name names course. And take notes.
Well, no. His mom, his dad and my mom did the yearbook at East High. I've known Eric I've known him for a long time. Just as I've known Tammy for a long time. You know, look, this is a state where you know people. And Eric, who was once a much more mainstream Republican, has gone very, very Trump in this election. But he has brought his own money, which is substantial, millions and millions of dollars. And he has drawn in huge amounts of money from outside the state, tens of millions of dollars. And so the fact of the matter is that, and I think Ben can confirm this or challenge, I think at this point he's outspending Tammy. And it's because of, A, this combination of his own base money with a huge amount of outside money. The Republicans, I think, have made the determination that if they can win Wisconsin, they get the Senate. And it's not that other states aren't significant. They are. But this is the place where it could really tip things in their favor. And so, you know, that's the simple reality. When you turn the TV on, Don, you will see stacked ads. In fact, they at the end of TV shows, they're sort of cutting off the credits at the end of the last TV show before the evening news to fit in all the ads.
These are all Eric Hovde ads.
No, Tammy Baldwin's got some ads up too, but the Eric Hovde ads are just, it's overwhelming. And the thing is, his ads were really bad initially because it looked like he was making them himself, right? They just were lousy ads. But when all that money came in from Mitch McConnell, they reshuffled Eric Hovde's staff, and the ads have gotten better. I mean, the fact is, whether you like it or not, he's closing with a strong ad campaign. And I think that's made the race a little bit closer. I don't think it's dramatically closer than it would have been anyway. You know, I think we'd have competitive races, blah, blah, blah. But the money is a real factor. The second thing you asked about was abortion. And abortion is a huge issue in Wisconsin. I can't begin to tell you, you know, how important it is. Part of it has to do with the fact that Wisconsin is one of that handful of states that had a kind of a sleeper law on the books, an 1849 law that pretty much banned abortion in every sense. And so when the Dobbs decision came down, suddenly, like literally active, you know, committed supporters of abortion rights, who in most other states would say, yeah, we can work around this. In Wisconsin, they said, you know, that law could put people in jail. And so we saw an almost immediate contraction of access to abortion rights in Wisconsin. It hit people hard. It was very, very notable. And that affected our politics profoundly. There is no question that in 2022, the issue of abortion rights played very significantly in our governor's race. And you saw Tony Evers, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin, again, Ben will confirm for me this, but like quadruple the size of his majority. I mean, he did a lot better running as a clearly pro-choice candidate. And the clarity of that issue, I think, helped him a great deal. Then the next spring, the control of the state Supreme Court flipped. With a progressive getting elected to the state Supreme Court. And there's no question. I can tell you how central the issue of abortion rights was. I was out. Our lakes freeze, you know, completely. And then at the University of Wisconsin in, you know, downtown Madison, they had a rave on the lake. There was a DJ set up and there's about 1,000 people dancing. And I dare say, and I know this is probably a rare development, but there appeared to be some drinking going on. And so it happened. I was walking across the lake. Like, I saw some kids from the neighborhood where I live. And, you know, and I said, hey, how's it going? Blah, blah, blah. And the weird part about it was here they are in the midst of a rave, dancing on a lake with maybe a little bit of drinking going on. And they said, this is like in April, early April or late March of 2023. They said, how's the Supreme Court race looking? Wow. You know, when you have college students asking you how the Supreme Court race is looking, you know that it's something real. And these were young women, and they made it absolutely clear that they were going to vote no matter what. And abortion rights was a central issue. So that's the fundamental reality, Don. And you see the ads like crazy in Wisconsin. I mean, abortion is one of the major themes that Tammy Baldwin has brought home again and again in her ads. Hubdi is trying to fuzz the margins. He's trying to, you know, talk around it and sort of undo some of his own past statements, which are very anti-choice. So I think it's a pivotal issue. If it's going to play anywhere, it's going to play in Wisconsin. The last thing I'll say about it, though, and I think this is an important thing. While abortion rights has been huge in Wisconsin, so too are worker rights. And I know it sounds like a big pivot, but it's an important thing to understand. I think there's these two issues that really do motivate people. And I think that what will decide Wisconsin is that combination of a strong message on abortion rights. If the Democrats deliver it effectively, I think their chances are increased greatly because you turn out a lot more younger voters there. But also that issue of worker rights, which has been like a brutal battle in Wisconsin, going back to when Scott Walker tried to overturn our protections for unions. That's a very, very big deal in this state as well. And how the candidates talk about it matters. Tammy Baldwin has spent basically her entire career as somebody who has made it really, really central to who she is. When the Wisconsin uprising occurred back in 2011 and students filled and young people filled the Capitol protesting in favor of labor rights, Tammy Baldwin flew home from Washington to be on the center of that floor, standing with them, defending the rights of unions to organize in Wisconsin. And I think you're going to see that as a factor, bringing us all the way around on your question, Don. You'll see that as a factor that may actually get her reelected, because I think she's going to have a portion of workers who might even be not as sympathetic to the Democratic Party as usual, who are going to remember that she has stood with them at every turn. And I think that's very likely to help her.
Well, let's discuss another factor briefly. I mean, the latest polls show Harris up by half a point. So essentially we're talking dead heat, you know, sweating it out to the last minute, as Ben said. And abortion rights, labor rights, all important causes which we care a lot about. But there's another factor in national politics that we like to talk about less, but which the New York Times, of all papers, has discovered may be at play in the race in Wisconsin, and that's race. You know, the Times had a story this week where they sent a reporter out to rural Wisconsin to discover that not everybody is so keen on voting for a black woman. And I wondered, you know, first of all, I'm sure you were both shocked to discover that. And secondly, to what extent is race or racism, to give it its full name, still a factor in why this race is so close, given the other factors you just mentioned, which should militate for a strong Democratic showing? And what else is at work or what else is not at work? And Ben, we're going to let you go first.
Sure. And I should say, so much of what I know about Wisconsin politics comes from John Nichols. So I'm going to walk through a little bit of history here, but the person I always call with questions about what has been and what could be is John. So it's exciting to be on here with you, John. The thing about Wisconsin, you know, there is a for a long time has been a big, especially you know, on the right push to exploit racism and fuel the fans of racism. There's also a deep streak of anti-racism in our state. The Republican Party was founded in Wisconsin as an anti-slavery party. There were riots to block federal marshals from trying to re-enslave people. It led to the state Supreme Court being the first of the nation to declare the Fugitive Slave Act unconstitutional. You fast forward 100 years, Wisconsin was the first state in the country to elect a black woman to statewide executive office. That's Vell Phillips. And she you know, made history. There's now a statue of her outside the Capitol that I was delighted to be at the unveiling of last year. So this is a state that has voted for black leaders and for white leaders. It's a state where in every election, Republicans try to use racism and fuel racial division in order to win elections. And they use sometimes coded language, sometimes they use a bullhorn. We see that every election cycle here. If you watch TV right now, every single ad is about crime, about undocumented immigrants, and about trans issues. And sometimes they mix all three together. And so they're trying to use fear of an other in order to get an overwhelmingly white state. But frankly, they're using these appeals to resentment, grievance, fear, division, also to go after Black and Latino and Hmong and Native American voters. Their goal is to fuel a sense of threat from the outside to whoever you might be in order to get people to reach for a strong man like Donald Trump. And by strong man, I mean that in the one word form, not in the two word strong man form. He's actually a very weak guy in a really profound way. But he's trying to appeal to insecurity that people have. And on the other side of the coin, we appeal to solidarity. Our core message is about the idea that we're all in this together, that we all do better when we all do better, that when we fight to support unionization and workers organizing, that makes everybody better off. When we fight for freedom for everybody, even men fighting for freedom for women and for people fighting for freedom for their brothers and sisters across race and across the gender spectrum, all of that helps us all be stronger and more effective. And that's kind of the existential fight. You're on your own versus we're all in this together. And both of those themes go through all the way through our history. And sometimes you see, we voted in landslides for Barack Obama, and then we've had white candidates the other four of the last six presidential elections, and we had razor thin margins. There's nothing baked in about whether racism rules the day, but it is absolutely, it's the Republican strategy to try to fuel it. And our job is to fight back against it by especially making the case that the reason why Republicans do that is because they fear the power of regular folks coming together across all of our communities to make things better for everyone. That's at the heart of our politics, is the work that it takes to ensure that everybody has opportunity, that everyone has freedom, that everyone has the chance to join together and fight for better wages and working conditions. And that message has prevailed in Wisconsin. We think it can again prevail in Wisconsin. It goes to both of the issues that John talked about abortion and reproductive freedom, and about union rights and workers. And we see both of those things across, up and down the ballot on the campaign trail across the state.
Have you ever wanted to learn a new language? Maybe you were inspired by a recent international trip, became obsessed with a foreign film or TV show, wanted to communicate better with a loved one, or just felt like developing a new skill. With Rosetta Stone, learning a new language is easier than you thought. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered, including Spanish, French, Japanese, Dutch, and more. Learning is immersive and designed for long-term retention, so you fully learn to speak, listen, and even think in that language. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
This is Scott Campbell from the Stupid Things for Love podcast. I have a 7-year-old son, and the biggest mountain I climb every day is trying to put shoes on this child. And I'm so grateful to Skechers for making the only shoes my son will willingly put on by himself. Their slip-ons are amazing, and he doesn't have to deal with laces. He doesn't have to deal with anything. They come in the perfect color blue. Thank you, Skechers, the comfort technology company. And you can find Skechers everywhere, Skechers.com, a Skechers store, or wherever stylish footwear is sold.
So, John, what are your thoughts about why it's so close and what the Democrats haven't yet done that perhaps they might do if they get the benefit of listening to your advice on this podcast in the last 2 weeks?
Well, I mean, clearly they need a new chairman. Ben has been one of the most successful Democratic Party chairmen, arguably the most successful in the history of the state, and really has transformed the party in fundamental ways. And I don't say that as somebody who's known him for a long time. I hear that from grassroots Democrats across the state. So, you know, when you ask what more do they need to do or what aren't they doing right?
Well, I should make clear the question wasn't primarily directed against Ben, although
no, I know that. I'm teasing. It's
more about the National Party and the top of the ticket, because we're all conceding that everybody in Wisconsin is running ahead of the top of the ticket. So,
yeah,
wouldn't it be nice if it were the other way around and they were pulling you on their coattails?
Well, that's the interesting thing about it. Yeah, when I looked at the polls this morning, Wisconsin is the, you know, the real clear politics poll of polls where they put them all together. Wisconsin's where the Democrats are doing the best, right? It's exceptionally close. But what that means is it's just exceptionally close everywhere. Folks are doing a little bit better in Wisconsin. Let me kind of intersect these two elements of this thing. And the first part is when you were asking about race, I think we have to talk about race and gender. You know, it is Wisconsin voted for Barack Obama twice. And in fact, it didn't just vote for Barack Obama. He did better in Wisconsin than most any place else, certainly than in other battleground states. He ran 3 points ahead of his national average or his national percentage in 2008 in Wisconsin. He ran more than 2 points ahead in 2012. The fact of the matter is that, you know, Barack Obama did great in Wisconsin, and he'll probably come back to Wisconsin before the election and be a really vital factor in rallying a multiracial, multiethnic coalition in favor of Kamala Harris. Interestingly, Hillary Clinton was the only Democratic nominee since 1988 to lose Wisconsin. Now, she lost it very, very narrowly, just a handful of votes. But I think we have to recognize that race and gender are both factors in this state, and we should, you know, be conscious of that and be conscious of the fact that I saw interviews, I think Ben did too, after the 2016 election, where the TV reporters from Madison went out and talked to voters in rural towns who said they voted twice for Obama, but then voted against Clinton. And some of them actually did the oldest, you know, most frustrating arguments about why a woman shouldn't be president. And so these are things that have to be addressed, and you have to respond to it. Now, I think Kamala Harris has done a very, very good job of doing that. In fact, I think she has created almost a new model for how to make a case for herself. And as somebody who is ready to be president, and she talks a little less than Clinton did about the historical nature of her candidacy and more just about the fundamental reality that she would be a better president. I think that's important. That's a big part of it. So that put that into place, but understand that perspective and those both challenges and opportunities. Then to this core question of why it remains so close. Look, I'm going to offer a view here that Ben may disagree with. And if he does, it's fantastic. I think a disagreement, and Ben and I have disagreed on things, you know, I think at least 3 times over the last 20 or 30 years.
well, we're hoping for 4.
Well, this could be the 4th. I don't know. Kamala Harris came to Wisconsin a week or so ago and went to Ripon, Wisconsin, the founding place of the Republican Party, to appear with Liz Cheney. I don't think that moved a single vote. And I see Ben's going to disagree. See, and that's great. But I think that in the aftermath of her stunningly successful presentation in the debate with Donald Trump, Kamala Harris has focused a great deal on the Republican support she's attracted. I don't have anything against that. I think that's fine. I think it's great that she's got Republican support. Obama did as well. But if I was going to focus on something, frankly, I would be focusing on a host of industrial issues, particularly Trump's NAFTA, as I refer to Trump's reform of NAFTA, which has been highly unsuccessful and actually has harmed a lot of workers, harmed a lot of factory towns in Wisconsin and nationally. And frankly, if I was going to go someplace with somebody instead of Liz Cheney, I would have appeared with Sean Fain from the UAW in a couple of factory towns. Now, that's my sentiment. And again, Ben may disagree, and he's a brilliant guy. And he's so much smarter than I will ever be. But I think that one of the challenges in Wisconsin is that there has not been a sufficient delivery of the message that Donald Trump is actually uniquely harmful to working class communities and to workers of all races, gender, background, however you want to talk about it. I think he's an incredibly damaging figure. And I think that days spent appearing with Liz Cheney or talking about Dick Cheney are not nearly as useful as days spent talking about factory jobs, building out our industries, and changing our trade policies from the absolutely destructive policies that Donald Trump put in to policies that can actually help Wisconsin communities thrive. So that's my take and why it is so close.
Ben, do you disagree?
I disagree in the sense that I do think that it moves.
I'm so glad. Good for the radio.
Yes.
That's why I said it. Yes.
Look, I think that there are enormous returns to making the kinds of arguments that John was just making, and I think we will see them made. And I think in different places she is making those arguments right now. There's been a lot of that kind of argument made in Detroit, for example, where Trump is taking it on the chin for his profoundly anti-union record from directly from our candidate's mouth. So and I think we're going to see that in Wisconsin too. And I think it's really critical to recognize there is a group of undecided voters in this election that is unlike undecided voters in most elections, which are high information, highly engaged Republican partisans who think that our Constitution is sacred and should not be shredded by a wannabe dictator. And, you know, a larger than usual percentage of those people appear on MSNBC every so often. Most demographics are not well represented on our nation's cable channels, but there are actually some voters across the state who they pay attention when Liz Cheney does this, when Dale Schultz, the former Republican majority leader in our state, just endorsed Kamala Harris. Bart Starr Jr., the lifelong Republican son of the famous legendary quarterback, he's been showing up in our state. Like I think we're seeing there's a group of Republicans for whom what Trump has done is a bridge too far. And when you look at, you know, there's both the persuade to participate folks for whom a lot of them are profoundly alienated from politics and hearing Bernie Sanders' message. He was just packing huge audiences in rural Wisconsin. He was in Baraboo talking to hundreds of people this past weekend. Those messages are absolutely critical around economic justice. And then also there is a share in a state where four of the last six presidential elections has come down to less than 1% of the vote, less than 25,000 people. There are many times that number of Republicans who just can't quite stomach the idea of voting for someone that they know has called for the Constitution to be terminated. These are often veterans. They're often people who have been very involved in civic life and serving their nation in the political system, who are kind of, even if though they disagree with me on almost everything, they're more idealistic than a lot of the folks who feel, you know, jaded and cynical about the whole system and might not get involved. And messaging to those people is a critical part of the recipe for victory. So I do think that it does matter. And I've spoken directly to some of the folks that it has mattered to. And I also think this is the art of addition. I think we need to reach each of these different folks. And, you know, a coalition that spans Dick and Liz Cheney to AOC and Bernie is a coalition where you can find 50% plus one of Wisconsinites. And, you know, we're up against some of the worst, oldest authoritarian tricks of divide and conquer, things that humanity has wrestled with for thousands of years in lots of different contexts. And that's what's coming at us from the other side, including the world's richest man who's funding the entire get out the vote operation on the Republican side right now. Elon Musk is doing it all through a super PAC. So this is like big, big forces at play. And my message is, this is a big tent moment. We need everybody coming in. We are going to fight for the most basic principles that make us who we are.
So I'm going to come back on that and just say, at the end of the day, while I respect the fact that Liz Cheney was born in Madison and Kamala Harris grew up in Madison, and so everything does come back to Wisconsin in every sense and in every way. And what Ben said is absolutely true about reaching out to Republicans. Still going to hold to this view that that in this narrow amount of time, I think for Democrats, where they're going to end up winning Wisconsin is by turning up the volume on those a lot of those labor and economic justice issues, and I think that at the end of the day, you're more likely to swing a vote by appearing with a union leader or with Barack Obama or even with Bernie Sanders than you are by appearing with Liz Cheney.
Well, there's the time question, which is this is a sprint, not a marathon. So every decision you make to do something means you're deciding not to do the three other things you might have done. But isn't it also that if you're trying to appeal to suburban Republican women, to put it at its most demographically precise, you're not able to talk about, or you are dissuaded from talking about, the kind of economic populist issues? I mean, some of us think that 2016 was lost on trade and NAFTA, and that and we're worrying that 2024, even though Kamala Harris is not Hillary Clinton, doesn't have to defend Bill Clinton's record, is likely to also be lost on trade, on NAFTA, because we're not talking about it.
Can I jump in and do the message before Ben does? Because I know Ben will say it better and wiser than I do. I think that in this case, Don, your premise is wrong. And I'll tell you why. There is not enough time. I mean, I'm just in shock when people say, yeah, the election is, you know, like 3 weeks away, or, you know, 20 days away. You know, this thing is coming so fast. And you can easily imagine there's not enough time. Wisconsin's a very, very big state. And you can do a lot on the same day in Wisconsin. You can have a Bernie Sanders appearing in Baraboo, Wisconsin, with an absolutely packed, you couldn't move in the gymnasium where he spoke. And on that same day, you can have, you know, people holding a press conference or doing an event on reproductive rights in suburban Milwaukee. And you know what I mean? You can do these things at the same time. And so I do think that countries around the world run elections in 3 or 4 weeks. It's not unheard of to have snap elections. We've got 3 or 4 weeks in Wisconsin. There is enough time to deliver a lot of messages and to do so. What I would say, though, is, and I think that the theme of what I've kind of brought to this, for whatever it's worth, is that I do think there's a need to turn the volume up on some of those union rights, economic justice, trade issues. And the weird part about it is, the fascinating part about it is, that Kamala Harris actually has a fantastic record in this regard. When Trump, quote unquote, fixed NAFTA, only a handful of people in the Senate opposed him and said, what you're doing is wrong. It's not going to make things better. One of them was Bernie Sanders. Another was Kamala Harris. And so the fact is, I think she has a very, very strong message on choice and on many of these other issues we're talking about. And she cannot dial that volume down. That would be foolish to dial the volume down on that. But I would like to hear the volume dialed up a little bit on the fact that she's actually running for president of the United States as a candidate with a good trade record.
Well, I'm going to chime in and speak to the other thing that you said, because you said you think that, you know, if you're running a campaign to appeal to, you know, white suburban women, then can you really make the economic populist argument? White suburban Republican women. And I want to tell you about two things that have one thing in common. So two things that have about 67% support, two-thirds support in Wisconsin and nationwide. And those two things are Roe versus Wade and unions. Unions, they are both super majoritarian institutions, and both of them are under sustained attack from Trump and Vance and the oligarchy. And both of them have a ton of support from a lot of Republicans who are divided about, you know, a lot of other things, who might oppose Democrats on lots of other things. There's a big pool of people where those things overlap. And, you know, across Wisconsin, you'll never get heckled for like championing union rights and championing workers' rights and for championing reproductive freedom. You'll never, as a Democrat, you'll never get heckled. I'm sure there's some Republicans. You saw at the RNC. Actually, you saw that moment when there was that speech by the Teamsters guy, and the room was kind of silent. They were not exactly sure what to say. Now, of course, the Teamsters in Wisconsin endorsed Kamala Harris at the rally in Madison, Wisconsin, that I was very proud to be at just the other day. But I don't think there's a big conflict between these things. And I think that I think we're getting a very strong message that we're carrying in lots of parts of the state about how Trump oversaw continued outsourcing of union jobs to non-union states and to other countries, shipping manufacturing jobs overseas, how the Harris administration wants to change that. I think there's room and opportunity to dial up the language around trade and trade deals and Trump's trade deals specifically. So I totally hear you there. And I also think the economic message in general has been very clearly targeted towards working people and has dramatically closed a gap that used to be seen as catastrophic. The public's trust for Harris on the economy has jumped up like multiple dozens of percentage points over the course of this flash campaign. And that comes from running in a way that's very clearly oriented towards the pocketbook issues that affect people directly and support for unions. I'll end with this. Tim Walz came to Labor Fest in Milwaukee, our big labor rally on Labor Day. He spoke from the stage, thousands of people roaring with delight there. And he said, you know, Republicans say I'm in the pocket of big labor. I'm offended. I am the pocket. And it was a great line. This is an unapologetically walk the picket line, pro-worker, pro-union administration and campaign. And that's paying dividends. We can see it in our state. So I don't think that there's a trade-off here. I think that there's trade-offs on lots of things. This is not one of them.
Well, actually, I have a picky question, and then I have an open-ended question. So the picky question is, if Wisconsin's such a state in which appealing to Republican women and appealing to strong pro-worker, tough-on-trade messages are not incompatible, why weren't you in Ripon, Ben? Why weren't you on that stage?
I think the main reason is the goal was to showcase having a Republican national leader on stage with Kamala Harris. And I, as the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, would not really showcase how Republicans are finding their way into this campaign.
And this is one of the reasons I really appreciate Ben, because if you ask that question of a lot of Democratic Party chairs around the country, they would find some weaselly way to get around it. He just told you the truth.
Well, okay. I just think that sometimes the broad church doesn't always appeal to all the worshipers, but who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. I'm hoping I'm wrong.
Well, the one thing to remember about Ripon is that Kamala Harris was a lot more closer ideologically to the founders of the Republican Party than Liz Cheney will ever be.
Well, that's true. That's true. And I guess, okay, so here's the broader question, which is, are there specific Wisconsin issues that we haven't covered that we should before we say goodbye to you two?
Yeah, let me start on one and then let Ben finish it off, because, you know, Ben's very complimentary to me about knowing about Wisconsin. You know, Ben literally spends so much time on the road going to every corner, every town in Wisconsin, that he's more than an expert on it. He's literally kind of woven into the fabric of the state and in fundamental ways. So what he says, I'm going to be very interested in. But what I will say is of a specific issue, it's not specific to Wisconsin, but it's specific to this region. There is an approach to agriculture and to small towns that is distinct to the upper Midwest. This is a place where you have a growing season that isn't all that long because it gets really, really cold, like 20 below zero for a good portion of the year. And so a lot of our farming is oriented toward dairy and just different ways of going at agriculture. And frankly, it's been hard hit over many generations now. We don't have as many dairy farmers. We don't have as many farmers in general. And yet, if you are in the biggest city, if you're in Madison, if you're on the east side of Madison at some hip cafe, and you go up to somebody and you say, well, what township are you from? Or what township were your parents from? They will remember the small town often, not always, you know, because people come from different places, different experiences, but they'll often remember the small town where their family comes from. They will remember the farm that they grew up on or that their parents grew up on. This is a state that still has a profound appreciation for agriculture and rural culture, for saving small towns, for making them vibrant. And so I would tell you that issues that resonate in Wisconsin, not uniquely, but with a special importance, is saving post offices, keeping them open, saving rural schools, keeping them open, getting them the funding they need, making sure that rural hospitals are open and well-funded and functional. These are huge issues in vast swaths of Wisconsin. And yes, they play big in the rural areas where they are, you know, practical experience of the moment, but they also play big in Madison and you know, other cities around the state, because people say, yeah, I don't live there, but my grandparents did, or somebody I know did, or somebody I know does. And so I think that candidates who are in touch with ag issues and with small town issues, with, you know, rural development issues, that gets them an extra bonus. I've seen it on the Republican side with folks like Tommy Thompson, who used to be the governor of Wisconsin. And I see it with Tammy Baldwin. You want to find somebody who can talk about dairy policy and farm policy in small towns? Tammy Baldwin's really good at that. And if and when she wins re-election, that's going to be a part of why.
Ben?
I want to build on this exact theme. This is something that people outside Wisconsin often do not get. There are other states where one big metropolitan area dominates the state, where more than half the population in Arizona lives in the Phoenix metro area, for example. The role of the Atlanta metropolitan area in Georgia, in Minnesota, it's the Twin Cities. In Wisconsin, you take everyone in the Milwaukee and Madison metropolitan area, not just the cities themselves, you get just over a third of the state. Two-thirds of people live in the rest of the state, and more than half of Wisconsin population lives in communities of 15,000 people or less. So this is a state of small and medium-sized towns. It's people call them water tower towns. You can see the water tower from your house. And when you drive around the state, it's not that these are the hinterlands and actually the hub of the population somewhere else. Most people live in smaller communities around Wisconsin where there is just the one public school. There's not like some select, you know, school choice thing. Republicans have these like school voucher, universal school voucher program fantasies. There's only one place to use your voucher in most of Wisconsin, which is the public school that has the same name as your town. Schools are a huge deal in Wisconsin. They're in state legislative races. It's interesting. Abortion is the number one issue. And that is both the biggest persuasive issue and mobilization issue. Unites Democrats, divides Republicans at this moment. But public schools come up in state legislative races in a massive way. When we talk about Project 2025, talking about eliminating the Department of Education is actually a reliable fact that will make crowds gasp. The idea that federal, you know, support for public schools will disappear, even though mostly it's state and local money that funds our public schools. The stuff that helps communities thrive, where you can actually move home or stay in the town where you grew up and live close to your grandparents, that means a lot. And that means supporting the farms, local farms staying open. It also means supporting local small businesses. The stuff that when Kamala Harris talks about the tax credits for people starting small businesses, that stuff actually matters a lot to people who are thinking about opening a store on Main Street, the same way as it matters to folks who are thinking about a small business in the city. The stuff that, you know, is not about the giant macroeconomic forces, but actually matters in a community where you can, you know, walk through both major intersections on your way to lunch. That stuff really matters in a state like Wisconsin. And it's one reason why I'm excited that Harris and Walz, you know, this week are visiting multiple cities outside of the bigger cities. It's why we had that event in Ripon. It's why our candidates are crisscrossing the state. It's why right now there's a tour with Tony Evers, Gretchen Whitmer, and Josh Shapiro going from small town to small town around Wisconsin. And we win by, even in places that are pretty red, we close the margins. We find more Democrats. We give people a sense that their vote can actually matter. And we do everything in our cities and in our suburbs, across race, ethnicity, gender, geography, generation. We have to do all of it to be able to win. So that there's a panoply of these issues, but it all starts with listening to people where they are about how to make life better where they are, not something that's far away. And if you do all that, you win Wisconsin.
If the Democrats win Wisconsin, you're going to want to replay that, people. You're going to want to say, how did they do it? That's how they did it.
But something Ben said I thought was very resonant and important about Wisconsin. It is one of the Republicans have thrown in so big on the issue of immigration. And they have run an incredibly xenophobic and often racist campaign nationally. And some of that has come into Wisconsin. And yet I would emphasize that immigration even plays differently in rural Wisconsin than I think it does in many other places around the country. Because many of the people who sustain our farms are immigrants, right? The people who work on those farms are immigrants. Many of the people who work in the small machine shops and on the main streets, who are literally revitalizing the main streets of Wisconsin small towns, are immigrants. And so I think that we've had a couple incidents in Wisconsin recently, or over the last few years, where they've tried to bring in some of the national anti-immigrant politics that the Republican Party has played in so much, and it hasn't gone so well because farmers in Wisconsin have stepped up and said, no, immigrants are a really big part of the dairy industry in this state. They are contributing mightily. Immigrants are revitalizing main streets in many of our small towns and contributing mightily. And so I think you see, as Ben's suggesting, right, when you listen to a place, you're going to find nuance there. And it is something that frankly, I think can undo many of the worst messages, the ugliest messages from Republicans can get undone on the main streets of Wisconsin small towns because people actually know each other. And they know folks have been there for six generations on a century farm, but they also know immigrants who've come and opened up a restaurant or a store in a town that didn't have a restaurant or a store and have, again, contributed mightily. And so I think that Wisconsin politics is complex and it's got ugliness to it. There's you know, I'm not going to try and paint it always as perfect, but one of the things I will tell you is that within that complexity, there are some real stories of what Ben refers to as solidarity and real stories of people getting beyond differences. And I am optimistic or hopeful or whatever, romantic enough about Wisconsin to believe that this election may well turn on the fact that people in small town Wisconsin and in our cities know each other better than some of the Republican strategists think.
All right. Well, on that hopeful note, I think it's a great place to end. Ben Wickhorst, John Nichols, it's been a real pleasure talking with you both. Thanks for coming on See How They Run.
It's an honor.
Thanks.